This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. I'm really looking forward to today's program. Today, out of respect for Mother's Day, our guest is going to be Dr. Danielle Luciano. Dr. Luciano is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut. She's also the interim chair of that department. And we're going to be talking about endometriosis and a variety of women's health issues today. So she'll be joining us a little bit later in the program to discuss those issues. If you have questions for her, you can reach out to me directly at info@alessimd.com. Well, I think it's time we revisit the chaos at the Department of Health and Human Services. And I do mean chaos. Right now, we have a newly nominated candidate for Surgeon General. Now, Surgeon General is considered to be the top doc in the United States. They become the director of the Public Health Service, and they are responsible for initiatives to make America healthy. And you'll remember probably, iconically, really, Dr. Everett Koop. See, Everett Koop was the Surgeon General who really waged war against the tobacco industry to, again, really helps the amount of lung cancer related to smoking go down. So the newly nominated Surgeon General is a woman by the name of Casey Means. Dr. Means is a graduate of Stanford University. She went to medical school and then went into a residency for ear, nose, and throat surgery. Now, this is a rigorous surgical residency. It's a five years to complete this. And you're taking a lot of call. You have to do general surgery first. And after 4.5 years, 6 months short of completing her residency, she drops out. She quits and decides she is disenchanted with organized medicine and wants to practice functional medicine and alternative medicine. Something's not right there. You just don't spend 4.5 years of your life and you're in the last 6 years, you're in the home stretch and you just quit. In fact, Dr. Means doesn't even have an active license to practice medicine. So get this. So the top doc in the United States can't practice any medicine because they don't have a license. And she now is going to lead the public health initiatives for the United States. How did she get that job? Well, she became a big supporter of Robert F. Kennedy. And she helped broker his deal with Donald Trump. And this is her reward. So with that, she has been nominated to lead this. And she is the leader of and the darling of the Make America Healthy Again movement, the MAHA movement. So let's talk a little bit about making America healthy again. Let's start with something we've talked about on this program repeatedly, measles. We're now over 1,000 cases of measles spread out in Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Indiana, Michigan, Montana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. Each of those states has an outbreak where there are more than 3 cases reported. Now, you might be saying, well, it's only 3 cases. 25 years ago, we had no states with 3 cases because we vaccinated people. It was wiped out. We did not have this virus around. So before we make America healthy again, maybe we ought to worry about keeping America healthy. But let's talk a little bit about the MAHA movement. You know, previously, this was this Make America Healthy thing, the things they believe, which are primarily two things. They are against highly processed foods, dyes, and pesticides. No argument there. No argument there. We have a crisis there. We have too much sodium in food. We have an obesity crisis among young people. That's not a political battle. That's something we should all be working towards. Nobody wants pesticides in their food. Their other big issue is vaccines. They are typically against vaccines, and that's a real issue because now we have measles. Now, previously, in the 1970s, people who believed these two things, they were called the crunchy moms, right? These were the old hippies who were out there, liberal, left-wing. This was their belief. Suddenly, this has now become an issue of conservative moms and this coalition behind Robert F. Kennedy. So, obviously, there's some good to be had from this movement in terms of food. But by the same token, right, they're against vaccines. And now we have Casey Means being nominated to lead the charge. But let's talk about one thing they have done already and taken action on with the Department of Health and Human Services is in relation to NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. This is the organization that is mandated to prevent injury, illness, and death in the workplace. That's their job. On April 1st, they lost upwards of 900 employees, a vast majority of its whole staff. It's not a big department. And this is a mass firing by, again, Robert F. Kennedy. So we're trying to make health America healthy again, but the organization that's charged with preventing injury, illness, and death in the workplace, let's get rid of them. Let's talk a little bit about what they do. NIOSH is instrumental in funding and advancing research on carcinogens and other dangerous substances, most notably pesticides. Wait, where have we heard that again? All right, so let's get rid of the people who are trying to get rid of pesticides in our environment. Let's talk about some of the things that have been shut down since April. There's a database to track cancer in firefighters because of them being around asbestos and other things. So that database is gone. There's a big study that has been done and they're working on the cardiac and pulmonary consequences of mold. Mold, right? This has been the cry of people. There's mold in the carpet, mold in our schools. What does it mean? Right? So it's important work. That research has been shut down. They noted a spike in lung disease in the silica industry. So people who make countertops, suddenly more people who cut down these beautiful countertops that we put in our homes are seeing lung cancer. So there's a study to track these people. Nope. That's gone. The trichloroethylene. Trichloroethylene, thanks to NIOSH, was again found to, it's a pesticide, a chemical that causes liver disease. And we have been able to ban that thanks to NIOSH in the last 2 years. But here's the real big one, I think. The Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program. Now, this is a program primarily that takes place in West Virginia. And what it does is it does periodic black lung screenings at no cost to coal miners. Because the data has shown us 1/5, 20% of coal miners who are actively working today have signs of black lung disease. They may not be symptomatic, but they are starting to develop and have signs of black lung disease. What's black lung disease? It's really a form of scarring in the lungs from inhaling coal dust. So as more you, the more coal dust you start to inhale, you start scarring. So they develop symptoms of obviously shortness of breath. They get emphysema. These are folks that go into a mine every day and subject themselves to this. So this study, which has been carried on for years, to provide these free screenings so we can help keep these people healthy, is gone. All their equipment has been locked up. All the people who have been working on this have been fired. What's really ironic, so here's some irony, right? We've got a program to make America healthy again, and we're getting rid of the programs that support that effort. What's also interesting is that these programs that I'm talking about specifically help and support the health of people who have supported this current government, right? When you look at how people voted, right, these are the folks in West Virginia, coal miners. Because everybody said, we're going to mine more coal. And that's what we're doing. We're going to mine more coal here in the United States. We're going to dig more out. But wait a second. We're not going to look out for your health. Firefighters, again, tend to vote conservative. Well, guess what? This is not what they signed on for. But unfortunately, they're going to have to live with this for a while. We're going to keep an eye on this because this whole thing with the Surgeon General nominee, Casey Means, and how she got there is really interesting. And the fact that she doesn't even have a license to practice medicine and is proposed to be the top doc in the United States. This is chaos. And it's important for all of us to understand this because it's affecting everybody, not just our tax dollars, but directly affecting our health. This day in medicine, May 10th, 1888, Dr. Rudolf Schindler was born. Dr. Schindler was a gastroenterologist in Germany, and he invented the first flexible gastroscope. Very interesting. So for any of us, it was important that you have these flexible scopes. And he really came up with the first one. Anybody who's had a gastroscopy would know that. But again, he was a German physician, and he was arrested by the Nazis. He fortunately escaped and emigrated to the United States in 1934, where he did phenomenal work in research in gastroenterology. And he passed away in 1968. So we remember Dr. Rudolf Schindler today on this day. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Danielle Luciano, who is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut. We're taking your questions regarding women's health issues. We're going to be talking about endometriosis. We're going to talk about egg retrieval and in vitro fertilization. We're going to talk about cancer of the cervix. So if you have questions, you can reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Danielle Luciano, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Luciano was originally, I guess, when we first started out, we've been on 16 years, so it's more than 10 years ago that Dr. Luciano was on with her father, Dr. Anthony Luciano, and they were in practice together, and subsequently moved over to the University of Connecticut. Danielle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Let's chat a little bit. So things have really changed. So you've been at UConn for 10 years, And Dad retired now?
Yep, he is all retired, and now I run our division of minimally invasive GYN surgery, and I'm currently the interim chair of the department. So things have definitely changed.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Tell our listeners really what involves OBGYN now. You already mentioned minimally invasive. Can you give us the scope of OBGYN as it is now?
So OBGYN is a really diverse field. It's actually part of the reason why I wanted to go into it, because it does a little bit of everything. So within the field of OBGYN, there is obviously the obstetrics, which is delivering babies. And within the obstetrics, there's also maternal fetal medicine, which is high-risk pregnancies and taking care of patients with high-risk pregnancies. And then there's the gynecologic portion of it, which is dealing with the GYN organs or the uterus, ovaries, and tubes. And within that, there are a couple of subspecialties. One is oncology, which deals with the cancer, or GYN oncology, which deals with the cancer of the uterus, ovaries, tubes, and cervix. And then there's minimally invasive GYN surgery, and that's what division I'm in, and we take care of benign GYN problems like endometriosis and uterine fibroids and pelvic pain and heavy vaginal bleeding. And then there's reproductive endocrinology and infertility, which takes care of patients with issues with fertility. And I think we're going to try to touch on that today a little bit about oocyte cryopreservation or egg retrieval and preservation. And then finally, there's other fields, but there's fields dealing with incontinence of urine, and that's urogynecology. And so there's a really diverse field, and we take care of patients all the way from when they're young all the way up to when they're going through menopause.
You know, Danielle, in many cases, you become almost the primary care physician for women. You know, so many women, you know, always go for their annual visit, but you may be the only doctor they see. Do you find that much?
I find that a lot. I find that especially in kind of the women in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s, because they are in that childbearing age and they're of the time where they're doing a lot of screening and seeing their gynecologist perhaps for contraception or for other issues. And so often they don't have a primary care doctor. So our responsibility is to take care of them, not just their GYN problems, but make sure that they're up to date with all their primary care issues as well.
When should young women start seeing an OBGYN and getting gynecologic care? I mean, I have four grandchildren. At what point do they transition from or in addition to their pediatrician to a gynecologist typically?
I would say typically women come to start seeing us around the age of 18, just to get established with an OBGYN, and sometimes because they have questions about contraception or about protecting themselves from sexually transmitted diseases. They don't technically need to start having cervical cancer screening or pap smears until they're 21, but we generally start seeing patients usually around 18. That being said, there are young women who have GYN issues before the age of 18, and sometimes they'll see a gynecologist much earlier, and that would be seeing a pediatric or adolescent gynecologist if they're really young, under 14. And then, you know, usually after that, a gynecologist without the pediatric subspecialty can see them, usually starting around the age of 15 to 16.
Okay, we're going to be taking a short break. I have to tell you, Danielle, I'm already getting questions in here about the topics we talked about. So I think we're going to have some interesting thoughts. So, Louise, we will get to your question and Kate as well. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Danielle Luciano from the University of Connecticut. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and today, in honor of Mother's Day, which is tomorrow. We are discussing women's health issues with my guest, Dr. Danielle Luciano. For those of you taking notes, if you wish to reach out to Dr. Luciano at the University of Connecticut, the telephone number is area code 860-679-8555. Danielle, let's get to the topic I really wanted to discuss, which was endometriosis. Tell us about it. What is it, and how many people does it affect?
So endometriosis is defined as a condition where tissue like the lining of the uterus, so what we shed every month with our menses, grows outside the uterus. So that means outside the cavity of the uterus. So it grows on the uterus or on the ovaries. It can grow on the bowel. It can grow on the bladder. It can actually even grow in distant organs like the lung. And endometriosis lesions will bleed into wherever they are and cause significant inflammation. And that inflammation causes pelvic pain, sometimes pain with bowel movements, pain with urination, pain with intercourse, pain with your menses, and unfortunately sometimes infertility as well. And it's associated with a lot of other comorbid conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, painful bladder syndrome, pelvic floor dysfunction. So it is a pretty significant disease. And what's also significant about it is how many people it affects. It affects 1 in 10 women of reproductive age in this country and around the world. And because of all of the symptoms associated with it, it costs about $100 million a year for the government to pay for the health and well-being of these patients. So it is a pretty significant disease affecting a lot of women and affecting the quality of life of many women.
So, first of all, affecting 10% of women worldwide, I mean, this is a huge problem. I'm assuming that there are varying degrees of it in terms of severity.
So there are varying degrees of the disease. It is a very heterogeneous disease, meaning it presents differently in all women. We stage it by surgical complexity, which means it doesn't have to do with how much it causes infertility or how much it causes pain, but just how difficult it is to remove. And so the stages are 1 through 4, very similar to cancer staging. But it, you know, I have women who have pain and no infertility. I have women who have infertility and no pain. I have women that have just bowel symptoms or just bleeding symptoms. I even have a patient who the majority of her symptoms are issues with endometriosis in her lung, and actually her pelvic symptoms are not that bad at all. So it really is remarkable how it can present so differently in so many different women.
Is there a genetic component? Is it something that you might inherit from your mother or other family members?
So we definitely see a genetic component to it. We know that if you have a family member with endometriosis, that you have a 7-fold increased risk of having the condition. But we also know that there may be environmental factors associated with it as well.
You mentioned the staging being similar to cancer, so it brings to mind, is there any relation between endometriosis and cancer? In other words, is someone with endometriosis more likely to develop a cancerous process?
So actually, unfortunately, there is some correlation. There is some data that suggests there are correlations with many cancers, but probably the most significant data is an increased risk of ovarian cancer in patients who have endometriosis of their ovaries or endometriomas. They are at an increased risk for ovarian cancer.
Is surgery the only treatment?
Surgery is not the only treatment. We have medical management as well. Unfortunately, we do not have a cure for endometriosis, and it presents in so many different ways that I talk about treating endometriosis as a bit of a team sport. So we have to treat it with surgery. We have to treat it with medical management. Often I have to work with my friends who are gastroenterologists or urologists to help with some of the bladder and bowel symptoms associated with endometriosis. Endometriosis also is associated with a fivefold increased risk of anxiety and depression. So sometimes I have to work with my mental health experts. So it really is a condition that, you know, we have to treat with many different modalities to really improve quality of life in these patients.
We have a question from Louise. She says, my daughter is 35 and struggling with adenomyosis, and she has been treated with high levels of hormone therapy without success. What can you tell us about adenomyosis and treatment with hormone therapy, Danielle?
So adenomyosis is a really complicated coexisting disease with endometriosis. Adenomyosis is when the endometriosis lesions actually grow into the muscle of the uterus. And the problem with adenomyosis is that it grows into the muscle of the uterus very diffusely. So like kind of like fingers and kind of infiltrates into the muscle of the uterus. And so it's not something that you can just cut out and then sew the uterus back together. It really kind of integrates itself all over the muscle of the uterus, and it causes heavy bleeding and pelvic pain. And so we often have to treat it with medical treatments. And adenomyosis is also progesterone resistant, which is one of the treatments that we use for treatment of endometriosis. And so we often have to use high levels of progesterone therapy to actually get an effect. And unfortunately, the only cure, and I'm putting it in quotes, is a hysterectomy for adenomyosis. So that's a really tough one for patients who still have not had children. And so those patients and want to have children in the future, and those patients often require pretty high dosages of progesterone therapy to control their symptoms while maintaining their fertility potential.
Is that fairly rare, Danielle, adenomyosis?
So it is fairly rarely diagnosed, let's put it that way. We don't know the exact numbers on it. Part of the reason is because definitive diagnosis of adenomyosis is only when you take the uterus out and look at it under a microscope and see the pathology. And obviously, if you're trying to treat a patient who doesn't want her uterus out, you can't definitively diagnose it. There are some very consistent signs by imaging that are consistent with adenomyosis, but unfortunately, that's the only way to diagnose it. And so as a result, our numbers are probably underrepresented for the number of women that actually have adenomyosis.
Can someone with adenomyosis still carry a normal child, go through a normal pregnancy?
They can. There are some studies that suggest they're at an increased risk for preterm deliveries, operative deliveries, meaning needing a C-section, and increased bleeding after the delivery or postpartum hemorrhaging or bleeding after a delivery. But yes, many patients with adenomyosis can carry a pregnancy.
I think this is a nice segue to our next topic, which is egg retrieval. So someone who may have adenomyosis or another process, would you recommend that they have egg retrieval and storage of their eggs should they wish to become pregnant later?
So that's a question that has been asked of me many times by my endometriosis patients, because we know endometriosis is associated with subfertility, and sometimes, you know, my patients are not ready to start a family yet. And so there is some association with endometriosis of the ovary and decreasing ovarian function or ovarian reserve or quality of eggs when the endometriosis is on the ovary for a long period of time. So sometimes I will encourage patients to consider freezing their eggs or oocyte cryopreservation to capture those eggs when they're healthier so that they can maybe use them later with in vitro fertilization.
So this is a fascinating topic for me because it's not something I know an awful lot about. And especially here, there was a recent a documentary on 60 Minutes about egg retrieval and the fact that so many women are opting to have their eggs frozen until they're ready to have children. Are you seeing this more and more in young women who want to pursue a career or for any other reason, even other than disease? I mean, we've heard about this with people who are getting ready to undergo cancer treatment and don't right. want to have their eggs radiated. But in people who are healthy, are you seeing more and more that they would rather have their eggs frozen?
Yeah, so, you know, there is a lot of interest in that now. Unfortunately, women do have a restricted time of fertility, different from men who have a longer time where they have fertility. And so I am seeing women who want to delay getting pregnant, but also want to, you know, have the potential to use their own eggs when they want to get pregnant in the future.
Do you find it kind of, I guess I find it somewhat amazing that this is becoming such a trend in the sense of how, first of all, the field has grown and the fact that so many women may be doing this or doing it now, or the fact that it's growing in popularity. Do you find it surprising?
No, actually, I think it's really pretty amazing. I think it's amazing that we have come up with a way to help women to pursue their careers and pursue their life goals and not have to give up the chance to be a biological parent for a child. I mean, I think, you know, 30 years ago, this wasn't something that we could do. And, you know, sometimes women may have chosen to have children earlier and then pursue a career later, or may not have realized when they were pursuing a career that it would be more difficult to get pregnant later. And, you know, now we've just opened up opportunities for women to have it all. And I think that's pretty, I think that's pretty great. I think it's a good thing for women in general, and allows us to really reach our potential, not only as mothers, but also within our careers or within our life goals.
You know, especially, I guess, one of the examples they used in the documentary was, you know, some women who just haven't found the right partner. And, you know, shouldn't feel forced to marry or start having a child just because of their biologic clock. So I think it's really given women a lot more freedom from that standpoint and possibly having more long-lasting relationships. So I thought it was fascinating. And if people are interested, I would suggest trying to look up that documentary on 60 Minutes. We do have a question from Kate, and that is, what's the best age for a woman to undergo egg retrieval?
So I don't know the exact best age for it, and every woman obviously is different. But we do know that there does begin to be a increased risk of genetic abnormalities or genetic mutations as women age. And generally what we consider, quote, advanced maternal age is 35. And so we know that that's when genetic mutations start to become more common. So generally speaking, you know, trying to do this before that age would probably be the best way to go. But Every woman is different, and every situation is different. So I would recommend reaching out to the reproductive endocrinologist or infertility specialist who do egg preservation and having a consult with them and discussing that as an option if that's something that you're thinking about.
Is that available at UConn now? Do you have a fertility specialist there?
Yes, we do. The group associated with UConn is the Center for Advanced Reproductive Services, and they do egg freezing or oocyte cryopreservation there. They have a program for that, not only for the cancer patients, but obviously for patients that are doing it for other non-medical reasons.
Can you talk a little bit about the process? In other words, how do they retrieve the, I'm talking from real basics here. How do they retrieve the eggs? What's the process of freezing them? The success rate, I guess, when you're freezing them and things such as that. What is the actual process when someone comes in and says, I'd like to have this done?
Well, I'll defer all of the major details to my colleagues that are specialized in this in the fertility center, but I can at least give a basic overview. So generally what happens is they will stimulate a woman's ovaries with medications that make the ovary mature more than one egg. So generally speaking, every month when we get our menses or we cycle, our ovary matures essentially one egg at a time. And so we can give, or these doctors at the fertility center will give medications so that you mature more than one egg at the same time. So 10 or 15 eggs or maybe even 20 eggs. And they will do blood work to test when the eggs are ready. And then you will undergo a procedure where you will have general anesthesia, and with ultrasound guidance, they will retrieve or suction these eggs out of your ovaries, and then they freeze the eggs. And in terms of success rates, again, it depends on the quality of the eggs. We'll defer that to my fertility specialist, but that's generally how that happens.
Now, we always hear the worst case scenario where, the freezing failed, the place ran out of power, or they mixed up eggs or things like that. Is there some governing body or some way that this becomes regulated or people are overseeing this stuff?
Yeah, so there are federal regulations, and then they're also within the society. And within the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, they have guidelines and regulations as well. So everything is pretty well regulated and controlled. That's what's important, because this is, a very delicate and personal situation. And, that's why it's important that we have regulation for that.
We're going to switch topics. I had sent you an article that I came across today, and that was the first at-home test kit for cervical cancer has been approved by the FDA. Can you talk a little bit about this at-home test kit and how that all works?
So my understanding of this kit is that it's what you would do at home is basically put a Q-tip inside the vagina, and then send that Q-tip off to the testing center, and they would look for the human papillomavirus, or HPV, and the subtypes of HPV that cause cervical cancer. And then if it detects those subtypes, then the recommendation would be to follow up with your OBGYN, because you would be at risk for cervical dysplasia or abnormalities of the cells of the cervix, which then could become cervical cancer.
So this is like do your own pap smear, basically.
Right, sort of. I think it's great in the sense that I always think that anything that gives a patient more control over their health care and more access to health care is always a good thing. But Pap smears and pelvic exams are not just about screening for cervical cancer. When you go see your OBGYN and we do your pap smear and we put that terrible speculum in there and look around, we're not just looking at your cervix. We're also looking at the vagina and we're looking at the vulva and we're looking for other abnormalities that, you know, may need to be biopsied or checked that are not related to HPV and are not cervical cancer. And then we're also examining your uterus and your ovaries, looking for cysts and for fibroids or things going on in your masses in your uterus and your ovaries. So I think it's great that we have this as an option, but I don't think it should replace visiting your OBGYN. I think it's still very important that you go and see your doctor at least once a year.
Since we're on the topic of cervical cancer, the HPV vaccine is fairly standard now as being offered to young women to avoid the human papilloma virus. Has that been an effective way of cutting back on cervical cancer, Danielle?
The data seems to show that it is working. It will take time to see the real significant changes, but it does seem to be making a difference in terms of the amount of cervical dysplasia or abnormal cells that we're seeing. But, you know, viruses are very good at mutating. And, you know, when the HPV vaccine first came out, it only had four different HPV variants in it. And now it has, I believe, 9 different variants in it. But we know that there are maybe 15 to 20 that cause cervical cancer because she, you know, like any virus, is able to mutate. So I think we will see a difference. And again, you know, I think it's important to try to reduce cervical cancer rates worldwide because it is a big problem worldwide. But I think it's going to take time before we're going to see a significant difference.
Are we seeing more acceptance of that vaccine? I know that, you know, usually people who are against vaccines are afraid it's going to cause autism, but obviously this is something that's administered, I would think, in their teen years. Are we seeing more acceptance of this vaccine?
Well, yes and no. There's also, you know, a lot of backlash on giving vaccines for something that's considered a sexually transmitted disease. It's very difficult because people who have cervical cancer as a result of HPV, it's not because they were having multiple partners and, you know, having multiple episodes of unprotected sex. So, you know, HPV can get it the first time, right? The first time that you ever have sex with someone. And so I think, you know, any vaccine that can prevent cancer or decrease the risk of cancer, no matter how you can get the cancer, is a good thing. But I know that this is something that for some patients and some families is difficult.
Now, it's not just for women, though. I mean, am I correct?
Yes, because HPV can also cause cancers in men. If men are vaccinated, then they're less likely to give HPV to women. So I have a daughter and sons, and I have had them all get HPV because I know the HPV vaccine, because I know that it's important for us to prevent it from spreading, not just in women, but also in men.
I think that's the best endorsement of a vaccine we're ever going to hear. Danielle, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for everything you do at the University of Connecticut in your Department of OBGYN. And for people who would like to reach out to Dr. Luciano, again, the phone number is 860-679-8555. Thanks again, Danielle, and best to your dad.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to my guest today, Dr. Danielle Luciano. Thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board, and Jeff Chandler, who's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Today's show was about women's health, and I think it's important that that's a big issue that we're facing right now in the health crisis in the United States. Women have a right to monitor and govern their own health, and we need to let our elected officials know that. With that, I want to wish everybody a happy Mother's Day. Next week, we're going to have a taped program as I will be attending the first communion of my oldest granddaughter. With that, many thanks to you all, and until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.